Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. And this week, we've got a big show about some tiny things. I'm talking, of course, about insects. Love them or hate them, they are utterly fascinating. And joining me today is someone who has spent a large part of his life collecting, studying and talking about them. Dr. Tim Cockrell is an expert in insect ecology and biodiversity, and Tim's research has taken him from Borneo to Papua New Guinea to our very own Natural History Museum. He's discovered new species, trained flies, and appeared in many documentaries such as Micro Monsters, Inside Nature's Giants, and even the rather spooky Spider House. He's also a natural showman with a flair for magic, fleas and fire breathing. And whilst there will be no fire breathing in the studio today, sad times, I can promise that our experiment this week will involve an explosion. And it's all about an insect that never drinks. So stay tuned for that. Tim, thank you for joining us today. And just so that we're all clear at the start of the show, please could you define for us what an insect is?
Oh, goodness me. That is, you put me right on the spot there. So an insect belongs to the group of animals that we call arthropods. So those are the animals with their skeletons on the outside of their body rather than the inside. So the arthropods include spiders, insects, things like millipedes and centipedes, but also crustaceans, crabs and lobsters and shrimps and things. And insects are actually found, they originated from within the crustacean group within the arthropods. So they have three parts of their body and six legs. Very concise definition there, wasn't it?
Three parts of body, six legs, and distantly related to crabs.
Something like that, yeah, that'll do.
Brilliant. Well, coming up, we'll be learning more about Tim's time in the rainforest, what a flea circus really involves, and producer Amna will be sharing a host of fascinating insect facts with us. But of course, we want to hear from you as well. So this week, we are asking, what is the UK's favourite insect? You can tweet us at Soho Radio, tell us your favourite, or guess what the nation's is, and we'll be revealing our own at the end of the show. Now, Tim, this is your mixtape. You have chosen all the songs for this morning. So what are we kicking off with?
So I think, well, it's a good idea to wake everybody up on a Saturday morning. So we're going to start off with What I'd Say by Ray Charles, an absolute classic.
See the girl with the rat that song. She can do the birdland all night long. Yeah.
Insects currently make up two-thirds of known species on our planet, but studies predict this could actually be up to as much as 90%. Beetles alone have 380,000 different species.
That is a lot of beetles on this planet.
It certainly is. There's an interesting thing about beetles as well, is that currently the people that study beetles claim them as the most diverse, one of the most diverse animal groups, but certainly the most diverse insect group. But that could possibly be down to the fact that for at least 100 years, nearly 200 years, well, people have been fascinated by beetles. It was a bit of a Victorian hobby to go out and collect beetles. So actually, as we start to discover more insects and we start to know more about insects, well, the balance will be redressed slightly. So the beetles will become slightly less diverse relative to everything else.
Oh, so it's like the self-fulfilling prophecy. Everyone wanted to find beetles, so that's why we found so many.
Exactly, yeah. And Charles Darwin, for example, was absolutely fascinated by beetles. And with Darwin, his finches, everyone talks about the Galapagos finches with Darwin, they actually weren't hugely important to him relative to the beetles. He was a beetle fanatic.
Now, I know that you collected quite a lot of insects when you were a kid. Did you have beetles in your collection?
Yeah, I didn't so much collect and kind of pin and kill insects when I was a kid. I was just fascinated with them. And I had the little Collins Gem book of insects. I've still got it, a kind of very well-thumbed copy. And yeah, I just used to go out in the garden and look at them and sometimes take pictures and then look at them and try to identify them in the book. So, but I should say that I have killed lots of insects now in my scientific work, which is, it's and kind of scientifically justified as well. It is justified, in my opinion at least, and in the opinion of most scientists, to kill insects to preserve specimens in museums, for example. It's a really important thing to do.
Yeah, because you've actually discovered new species, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing about discovering new species in that it's actually extremely easy to find a new species. So if you go out into a rainforest and you basically take a net, you know, just a net that looks like one of those small fishing nets that you go pond dipping with, and you wave it about in the undergrowth, wave it about in some bushes, and I guarantee if you do that for a few minutes, you will have new species in that net.
No way.
It's actually quite an easy
thing
to do.
Just go out, wave a net, and you're like, woohoo!
Yeah, and because we know so little about the diversity of animal life and all the other life on this planet, that we've just touched the surface in terms of the things that we've discovered and the things that we've described. And in fact, you know, if you put your mind to it, if you chose the right group of animals, you could discover a new species in the UK as well.
Wow. No, okay, so let's go back to the rainforest. I'm going to set the scene. Now, you've actually provided us today with some recordings of birds of paradise from Papua New Guinea.
Let's fade them up. Yeah, when I was listening to this recording the other day, just before I sent it to you, I kind of suddenly realised how much a bird of paradise sounds like a seagull squawking. So they actually look a lot more sensational than they sound.
And why were you in Papua New Guinea? What were you doing out there?
I was doing some research for Oxford, for the University of Oxford, and we were looking into the ecology of rare species. Oh, that's me trampling about in the rainforest, walking from one tree to the next. Yes, I was looking at rare species in environments, because we know vaguely, we've got some idea of different trophic levels, as we call them, in ecosystems. So what feeds on what? So you go right from the top, from the top predators all the way down to the insects, and then the insects that feed on plants. So right from the top to the bottom, we kind of know how structures, how communities are structured, but we don't know anything about rare species. Because all of the research that's been done so far has been done on common species, just because they're the easiest ones to get hold of and look at.
Yeah.
So we don't actually know whether rare species actually do anything in an ecosystem. Are they just kind of tinkering away in the background and not really affecting everything else, all these other processes? Or do they actually have a role? Do they influence what goes on? So it's these fundamental questions we've still got absolutely no idea about.
And did you find you were coming any closer? Or?
We're still looking. I mean, the thing with this kind of research is that we go and collect insects and we collect plants and we look at them, and then it takes a long time to identify all of those. You know, we bring them back, some back to the UK, some back in Europe, and some still in Papua New Guinea. So that process has just begun. I mean, it was months ago that we actually did the field work, but we're still doing the work of identification and then statistical analyses and all that kind of thing. So yeah, watch this space.
Long, slow process. And what is it like living in the rainforest for such a long time?
God, it's fantastic. It's depends on your constitution, I'd say. There are some people that walk into the rainforest and they are absolutely astonished by the diversity of things that you see, for example. So they look at all the plants and all the insects. And then there are some people that walk into the rainforest and they're astonished at the lack of life there. You know, some people expect tigers walking around and monkeys flying through the trees. And in fact, those are the kind of things you see unusually. In terms of how comfortable it is, it's extremely hot, it's extremely humid. But if you're one of those people that focuses on this amazing diversity and the experience, it can be a wonderful thing.
Wow. And how did Borneo and Papua New Guinea compare? Because you've worked in both. Borneo is the country with the most insects in the world, isn't it?
Well, it's rainforests in general are the kind of hotspots of biodiversity that we, as we call them. So Borneo, in terms of the plant species, for example, I think more plant species per square meter have been found in Borneo than anywhere else. But who knows whether it's just that's the place where the work has been done. So I don't know, in terms of comparisons of rainforests, they're pretty much all extremely diverse, we can say that.
Yeah.
And there is some statistic, I won't get the numbers exactly right, but it's something like in a hectare of rainforest in Borneo, there are more species of plants than there are in the entire of the UK. It's something like that. Won't be exactly right, but something around that. It's astonishing just how many species there are packed into such a small space.
Yeah, no wonder just waving a net, you're like, oh, I've discovered so many more.
Exactly. But again, you go out in the UK, if you choose the right group. A friend of mine, he discovered a new species of parasitoid wasp a couple of years ago, and he discovered it by, he looked on one of the leaves on the trees in his son's school playground. And just because he knows a lot about that particular group of insects, he's looking at the leaves and something wasn't quite right. So he took a leaf off, he reared out the insects that were inside, he looked at them under the microscope, and he had a brand new species.
Wow. And so did you ever get like insect overload? Did you ever get annoyed at them sort of being all around you, creepy crawlies kind of in your bad.
No, I don't get that at all, actually. And yeah, I think you have to be quite resilient to live out in the rainforest, to spend time out there, because lots of the rainforest is trying to eat you. So the rainforest, when you get to a rainforest, it's just gradually trying to consume you and make you part of the rainforest. So, but that's everything. It's you and then everything you own as well. So all of your bags go mouldy. And there's a horrible fungus which gets inside camera lenses and eats its way across the glass. And it can kind of etch the glass, so it ruins camera lenses. It's a horrific thing. But of course, then there are the leeches and the parasitic mites and bot flies and all sorts of things. But to be honest, it sounds terrible. But once you're there, the first time you've been bitten by a leech, well, then the bubble is burst almost literally.
bitten by them all.
Yeah, exactly. So once you get used to that, it's all fine.
And we have a little feature on Science Mixtape, which we like to call Fieldwork Faux Pas, just to share the kind of grit and things going wrong. And, you know, science isn't always super straightforward. Have you got any particularly good fieldwork faux pas that you can remember?
Gosh, there was one in terms of a faux pas. There was one time. There was one time I was out in Borneo, and I was with a local guy who was from the Orang Sungai tribe, so the river people tribe, who have, incidentally, the biggest, widest feet I've ever seen, which is presumably an evolutionary thing that the tribe who's kind of evolved walking around in the rivers have these huge, huge, wide feet. It's an absolutely astonishing thing. But there's this lovely guy who was showing me around in the forest, and he took me fishing, and we caught this catfish. And he was somewhere around the corner, and this catfish was on the end of the line, and I stupidly grabbed hold of it. It was only a tiny thing. And I grabbed hold of this catfish, and it jerked itself around, and it turned out it was a venomous catfish, and it had a spine in one of its pectoral fins, and it stabbed the spine into me. The end of the spine snapped off, and it injected its venom.
Oh, my God.
And the problem was that this guy was such a lovely guy who was taking me. When I said, I've been stung by this thing, is it bad? And he looked at me with this pained look on his face, all the blood drained from his face, and he said, oh Tim, that's really, really bad. And it was just because he was so devastated that he'd forgotten to tell me about this thing, and it actually wasn't that dangerous, it was painful. But at that moment I thought, oh, this is it, this
I'm gonna die
it. Yeah, I've got 10 seconds to live.
Oh my God.
So that was the thing, not knowing about the species and not knowing about these fish before I stupidly grabbed hold of it. That was a faux pas, I suppose.
So when you had this kind of near death experience, did you get like the classic like life flashing before your eyes? Did you just suddenly feel like blank, or like how did you feel?
Yeah, almost. I just kind of panicked. I lied down on a rock and just looked at the sky and thought,
I'm going to take it all in before I go.
There could be worse views to have. Is it your last view? That's it.
Wow. Perfect time to move on to your next song. But first, I know that you worked with David Attenborough. What was he like to work with?
Oh, it's horrible. I had really bad breath, actually. No, I'm joking. No, it was exactly as good as you'd expect. But the one thing about working with Attenborough is that, and I spent quite a bit of time with him over a week in the rainforest. Mm. And the thing that doesn't come across so much on TV, just because I don't suppose he has the opportunity to project this, that he's extremely funny. He's
really?
A real raconteur. You know, I mean, you expect him to be a good storyteller, and it's exactly as you'd expect. You know, you sit next to him, and he launches into a story about animals, and there it's like having your own private documentary. But then also very funny, and he's got a bit of a kind of rude sense of humour, so he's very witty person as well. So really, yeah, didn't let me down at all.
Loving him even more. Right, next song, what are we going to next?
So we'll stick with the jungle theme, and we'll go with Wanna Be Like You by Louis Prima.
Now I'm the king of the swingers, oh, the jungle VIP. I've reached the top and had to stop, and that's what's bothering me. I wanna be a man cub, and stroll right into town, and be just like the other men. I'm tired of mugging around. Oh, ooby-doo, I wanna be like you. I wanna walk like you, talk like you. You'll see it's true.
Insects do not breathe through their mouths. They inhale oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide via holes called spiracles in their exoskeletons.
Amazing. Imagine if we could all just breathe through our holes in our skeletons. They have some fascinating adaptations, don't they? I mean, they don't even have proper blood or kind of hearts like we do.
No, I mean, but right now, this is the thing. I tell you what, just before we go into that, I need to mention about that song, The Jungle Book, because it sounds like, you know, just a comedy song, but it actually has a real meaning to me, because the first time I saw a live orangutan in Borneo, it should have been this completely, and it was a magical experience, you know, the tears welling up in your eyes, seeing this iconic species, but all I could think of was that song from The Jungle Book just playing in my head. And it's because when I saw that orangutan, it really made me realise just how good the animators on The Jungle Book were. And with King Louis, the orangutan, they really, really caught the character of an orangutan. But it kind of made it from a magical moment into a slightly comedy moment.
Kind of lazing around in a throne, yeah. Eating some bananas. Oh, yeah. Incredible.
And again, as well, Louis Prima, the guy who sang that song, the animators in The Jungle Book based the Trooper Monkeys on Louis Prima's band because they were famous for re-performing and literally aping around on stage. And there's some footage of the band kind of dancing about on stage with the trumpets, and they're kind of aping around just like the monkeys. And Louis Prima is fantastic as well, independently of that. So I'd recommend anyone who's never listened to his other stuff to just go and Google Louis Prima and find out some of his other songs.
There you go. Heard it here first. Louis Prima, one to listen to. That's so cool. So that must be why they called him King Louis.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. But as you're talking about insect adaptations, now this is a really interesting perspective that we have as humans. I think to be kind of anthropomorphic is kind of reasonable for us because we're humans. Mm-hmm. But we need to be aware that we represent a tiny, tiny minority of animal life. So in fact, animal life on the planet is pretty much insects. So I think it's maybe 90% of animal species are arthropods, and insects overwhelm all of the other animal species put together. So there are more kinds of insects than everything else put together. So in fact, when you say that insects, isn't it weird that they breathe through spiracles? They've got this open respiratory system. Well, in fact, no, we are doing things in a really strange, weird way. And insects are doing things in the way that is the normal way to be an animal on planet Earth is to be an insect. So we're kind of very inefficient.
We're the alien creatures.
Yeah, we're very inefficient, leaky animals. And in fact,
energy
insects,
intensive.
Yeah, exactly. So we're the exception. We're the real weird ones.
They're the rule. Got it. Well, you are going to be telling us all about an insect that never even drinks.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, again, another example of how we are the weird ones. So this is a kind of normal thing to happen. So we're going to film this, are we? We're going to film this demonstration. Yeah. So we're going to talk about an insect that never drinks. There's a moth, and it's a tiny, quite boring-looking brown moth called a Pistia quenella, and it's the Mediterranean flower moth. And there was an experiment done in the 1940s at Imperial College, not too far from here, and they took these moths and they put them in a desiccator. So this kind of machine that removes all of the humidity from the air. Now, the humidity is around 60-odd% quite often in the UK, and in the Sahara Desert, it gets down to about 25%. The humidity in this desiccator was approaching 0% humidity. Not quite, but approaching 0%, so less than 1% humidity. No water in there. The food that these moths eat, flour, just dry flour. And they managed to rear these moths from egg to larva to adult to egg. They managed to rear them through a generation at 0% humidity. So you think, well, that's incredible. Water is essential for life. How on earth did they do it? And the way they did it is that insects have this incredible trick where they produce water chemically. It's called metabolic water. So the food that the insects eat, the flour, it has carbon, it has hydrogen, it has oxygen. And they kind of, you know, when we see, say, burning fuel or burning food inside ourselves, well, it's a kind of similar reaction to combustion. So you're reacting the fuel, the food, with the oxygen in the air, and you're producing carbon dioxide and water. So you're actually producing water from its chemical elements rather than extracting moisture from the environment. And when I talk about this, I have this demonstration basically to show people that you can take something extremely dry. So this, what I've got here is a party popper.
Now it's not just any party popper.
Well, no, this is not your normal party popper. This sounds like the kind of Marks and Spencer's advert, isn't it? But I've tipped out the inside of the party popper and put a little bit of a pyrotechnic charge in it. So I hope I am sitting underneath a smoke alarm as well, but we'll see how it goes. And so I'm just going to put my tough gloves on just so I don't burn my hands. So I'm going to try to pop this party popper into this glass jar here. Now it's quite a cool glass jar, but the thing to bear in mind, and it's just to hammer home the fact that everything is completely dry. You know, the jar is completely dry here, the party popper's dry, the stuff inside the party popper was dry. And Matilda, I need your finger ready just for the end of it, just in a second. So I'm going to pull the string here and pull it and try not to get it in my eyes. Here we go. So there we go. So there's a flame inside this glass jar. So take your finger now and you wipe inside of the jar and you can feel moisture.
Yes. Yeah, I can.
So
that
water there, that liquid, is not something that's condensed from the air. So that is chemical water, almost like metabolic water. It's water that we've just made by reacting oxygen with the fuel that is inside there. And that is the trick that these insects do. But not only that, a lot of insects do this, so this is not an unusual thing. So in the animal kingdom, surviving to some extent from this metabolic water is quite a normal thing to do. So again, we make a bit of metabolic water, but such a tiny amount, it doesn't make much difference. Mm. But again, we are the weird ones. We're the unusual ones in the animal kingdom.
And that's something that actually like camels do as well, right? When they store the fat in their hump and then they're able to survive without drinking very much because they can get water from the fat.
So they'll extract that water chemically, yeah. So it's not like there's a kind of tap on the bottom of the hump that they turn on and the water dribbles out, which is what a lot of people do think.
Yeah, so it's like literally water in the hump.
Yeah, so it's a kind of chemical process. But again, camels are very, very unusual as mammals in that they're actually reasonably efficient. But compared to an insect, they are absolutely nothing.
Insects ruling the world. And like my favourite fact, which I've actually said on the show a couple of times, is that ants only need to sleep twice a day for 8 minutes. They're just like, you know, I feel like all the things that we need to do, like we need to drink and eat, and like you said, we're so inefficient, and insects just like charging around, never stopping, like almost like little mini living machines.
Yeah, God, I don't even know if the concept of sleep works for insects. That's a concept kind of based on mammals. That's a tricky thing when you're trying to project these human-based concepts onto insects. So yeah, do insects sleep? That's really good. That sounds like a pub quiz question, doesn't it? I'm not quite sure.
Your next song is Occupation by the Skaterlites. And why have you picked this one?
This is because I'm interested in all sorts of different genres of music, and I couldn't pick a playlist without putting some proper first wave Jamaican scat on. So here we go, it's from the Skaterlites.
And to anyone that wants to see that experiment, there was a very impressive flame with the bang, so definitely have a look on the Soho Radio Instagram and Twitter now.
Fleas are excellent jumpers. They can propel their bodies more than 200 times their length. This allows them to easily move from host to host and into their surrounding environment.
Fleas. Itchy, scratchy, amazing jumpers. But what most people have heard of is a flea circus. Now, I'm telling about you, Tim. I just thought flea circuses were like a trick and fake, but you said they actually used to exist and be done with real fleas.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And how long have we got? Because I could go on about flea circuses for literally hours, but I'll try to keep it short. Yeah, so the flea circus, if you go and see a flea circus nowadays, it's actually a magician's trick. So there are kind of invisible wires and magnets moving little things around, making you think that fleas are there. But this show is based upon something that used to be completely genuine. So if you were alive in the 1950s and you went to see a flea circus on a fairground or a sideshow, you would see real live human fleas attached to chariots, pulling chariots along. You'd see them fixed on their back and juggling a ball in their little legs. You'd see them pulling a carousel around. So flea circuses used to be a completely genuine thing, but they're not anymore.
How did they get them to do all those things though? Are they like actually training them like the way you would train a dog? Is it like still a bit of a trick?
Well, there's a bit of showman's license involved, of course, so you can't trust everything that a showman tells you, especially when he's trying to sell you a ticket to get into the flea circus. What I will say is that, I mean, there's part of it is taking advantage of the natural history and the natural behaviour of a flea. So fleas like to jump, so you get them to hold a little ball in their legs and they'll kick it out as they try to jump. But there is a thing that insects have been trained in the past. So you might have heard of this, where they use bees as bomb detectors, explosives detectors, or drugs detectors. So there's a little thing, and yeah, Google this. The videos of this fantastic. So they take bees and they get them to associate the scent, because of course insects are extremely good at detecting kind of things on the molecular level. So they've got extremely efficient antennae, these kind of sensory systems on the antennae. So there's this thing where somebody has it almost looks like a little bee handbag, a kind of handbag filled with bees, and this is genuinely a real thing. So yeah, look at the pictures, and they fill it with bees, and they train the bees to associate the scent or the detection of explosives or drugs with a sugary reward. just called bees are always looking for some sugar.
Yeah.
And what happens?
Delicious nectar.
Yeah, exactly. So then what happens? They take these trained bees and they wave them around in the airport. And if they detect the smell of explosives or drugs, well, the little tongues of the bees come out and wiggle around because they're waiting for the sugary reward. Yeah. So although it's so the concept of a flea circus, everyone says, oh, you can't train an insect. Well, I'm not going to tell you exactly how the flea circus works, but I will say that there is scientific evidence that you can actually train insects.
Wow. And you've trained flies, haven't you?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So we did a programme on BBC Four called Edwardian Insects on Film. And we were looking at this fantastic pioneer of natural history photography called Percy Smith. And one of Percy Smith's iconic films, I think it's from 1908, so over 100 years old, is a fly sitting in a chair, juggling a little ball in its legs. So he was a pioneer of natural history photography and macro photography. David Attenborough is a huge fan of Percy Smith. And we managed to recreate this using an original camera from the period with a kind of a wooden box winding the handle on the side. So my job was to get the fly and to train the fly to juggle the little ball.
And did you do it the same way, like with a sugary treat type situation? Or
no, I mean, this was kind of... I had to take lots of things into account, the time of day and the species of fly and the way we attached the fly. So there were lots and lots of different things involved. But essentially, the fly kind of sat in the chair and it tried to walk around and wiggle the ball around in its legs.
Ah, amazing. Mm. And you've always been quite interested in magic, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that was the kind of other side of the things that I do is I've got the biology side, but also the performing side. So I make my living in part through being a fire eater and escapologist and doing all sorts of strange and wonderful circus things like that.
What have you escaped from?
Oh, that, I mean, my standard act, the acts that I normally do, I escape from a regulation straitjacket. So I get tied up in a hospital straitjacket from by two big burly blokes in the audience and 50 feet of solid steel chain. So they wrap me around and tie me up with padlocks, and then I have to try to escape. I try to beat Harry Houdini's own record of 7 hours.
And did you?
No, 2 minutes. 2 minutes.
You say 7 hours is a really long show. Just watching Tim fight with some steel.
Yeah, the Victorian escapologists actually used to do that. Sometimes they literally take an hour or so to get on stage, and you read these reports and think, God, what were the audience doing in that time? I suspect they were drinking.
Definitely. And very quickly, the science behind fire eating, because that is fascinating.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we have there's a film actually online that you can watch on the RI channel, the Royal Institution's fantastic online channel, where we've got a clip about the science of fire breathing. And then also, so rather than explaining it now, I'll just kind of point you to those resources. There's one on the internet, but then also if you watch the One Show on BBC One later on in the year, well, we'll be doing a bit on the science of fire eating and fire breathing there as well. So look out for that.
Okay, so stay tuned.
Yeah.
One Show. Your next song, we are going to Etude in number 3, E major by Chopin. And why have you picked this one this morning?
This is just, and again, I love all sorts of different genres of music, and I wanted a classical piece in there. I'm fanatical about the piano as well. I don't play classical piano. I do play the piano, but not classical stuff. So this is if you ever need to chill out, this is a perfect piece of music. Just listen to it, and it feels like you're floating along on a cloud. It's wonderful.
Spider hares are hydrophobic, and that means that they don't like water. So when they're submerged, they trap a film of air against the body, acting as an oxygen supply. Amazingly, this bubble acts as a gill for a few hours, with oxygen from the water diffusing into the bubble and allowing the spiders to breathe underwater.
That is why you always get spiders in your bath. Flush them down the plug hole and they actually just like can breathe in the water. I don't know. When I found that out, I was like, oh, it all makes sense.
That is not the official advice, by the way. Don't flush spiders down the bath, because there's all sorts of nasty stuff down the bath that actually breaks that surface tension on the hairs. So, in fact, if you do flush a spider down the bath, well, you'll kill it. So please don't do that.
No. We asked you at the beginning, what is your favourite, or what's the nation's favourite insect? And I have to say, spiders are probably one of my least favourite. just, I don't know why, I guess I don't like the idea of like something living in my room, which is my space. Fine if it's in a bush, but not in my room. But they are the insects I probably have the most respect for. I just think they're absolutely fascinating and they're so clever, and like the webs that they make is just amazing.
They, yeah, and we should be clear that of course spiders aren't insects. Spiders are arthropods, so they belong to that kind of wider group of animals with exoskeletons, but they are arachnids. And in fact, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that the insects originated in evolutionary terms from within the crustaceans. This is a fairly recent piece of research. You know, for hundreds of years that we thought that insects came from a completely different area of that arthropod family trees. But in fact, we now know that they're from within the crustaceans. So in fact, spiders are right at the other end. So people thought that insects and spiders were kind of a sister group, you know, really, really closely related. But now we know that they're a bit more distant. Yeah, so spiders have only two segments of the body, whereas insects have three.
Yeah, sorry, rookie error for me. I mean, if I'd thought about it, I probably would have worked that out. But either way, people treat them like insects, I suppose. Like, we see them in the same places and have the same feelings towards them of like, oh, insecty, nasty, creepy, crawly, spooky. But you actually, I want to set the scene, had to work in a spider house, like a house just full of spiders.
Yeah, that's right. So I presented a documentary on BBC Four a couple of years ago with Alice Roberts, and it was called Spider House. And the premise of the show was that we would fill a house full of spiders and basically spend a couple of weeks looking at them and seeing what they did. And it's that idea. I mean, it sounds like a strange idea, first of all, but everybody's watched a natural history documentary. Everybody's watched Attenborough on telly talking about lions on the Serengeti, or giraffes, or, you know, orangutans in the jungle. But all of those dramas that you see, because when you watch a wildlife documentary, you're talking about the dramas in the life of an animal, aren't you? About how they catch their food, how they find a mate, how they avoid predators. And all of those dramas go on at exactly just the same kind of scale, but with the smaller animals on planet Earth. So all of those dramas in the life of a lion, you get in the life of a spider. So just by taking our focus down to the smaller things, we actually uncovered some incredible footage of how spiders find a mate, how they make a web, and how they catch their food.
Because they don't, when they're finding a mate, doesn't the male have to like bring a gift for the female to stop her eating him?
Yeah, in some species it does. They have these kind of nuptial gifts, which is exactly that, a kind of distraction tactic. Some males of some species actually have taken that behaviour a step further, in that they make this little parcel, but it's actually an empty parcel. So the female thinks that it's a parcel full of food, and then a few of the males in the population will do that, and just as he's mating, and then scarf it while she unwraps the parcel to find
that
it's
sneaky.
Yeah, so, but there, again, I mean, the diversity just in spiders, it's just so much bigger than in mammals, for example, in terms of the kind of courtship rituals and courtship displays. There's just such a kind of wealth of a diversity of incredible behaviours just within this group that we think of as a tiny, small group of obscure creepy crawlies. Well, they just kind of overwhelm everything else if you just take the time to look at them.
Was there anything particularly surprising that you found from watching them in his house?
Yeah, I mean, there was one thing that we did an experiment that was done at Oxford quite recently, and it's, we now know that spiders' webs, the kind of big round webs, the orb webs that we call them, the ones that look like the spokes of a bike wheel, that, you know, the kind of stereotypical spider's web that catches flies, we now know that they have electrostatic properties. And what this means is that it's probably the case that when a fly is flying around in the air, it's brushing its wings against the air, and the friction between its wings and the air charges the fly with a static charge. So the fly, charged up with static, flies past the spider's web. And when it gets caught in the web, it's not just a case of the fly getting caught in the web. The web is actually electrostatically attracted to the fly. So the web actually reaches out and grabs hold of the fly.
So it's like when you rub a balloon on your clothes and then it attracts your hair.
That's right.
It's exactly that force.
Yeah, exactly the same.
Oh, so it's not just sticky, it's suctioning it in by it. Kind of electrostatic force.
Yeah, which is incredible. And we, on Spider House, we did an experiment where I stood on a big Van de Graaff generator with a dead fly in my finger. So kind of me and the fly were both charged up, and we let go of the fly near the spider's web. And you can actually see the web pulling itself out and jumping and grabbing onto the fly as well. It was astonishing.
That's incredible. Well, perfect for your next song, which is Spider in My Room by the Bare Naked Ladies. There's a spider in my room.
I better grow some fins, 'cause it would make it easier to see.
indeed that part of the show where we bring our weekly science news to the table. Tim, what have you brought with you this week?
So there has been some research published recently with praying mantises. Now, praying mantises is one of my favourite insects, very, very charismatic, one of the few insects that can turn their heads, and they turn their head better than any insect without moving their body. And scientists have just discovered, now it's long been thought that that praying mantises have 3D vision, they've got very big eyes, very good eyesight. But just to kind of confirm this, nobody's done very, very good experiments just to check whether this is the case. And it's a really interesting way of doing it. They actually created 3D glasses for a praying mantis.
Oh my God, like mini 3D glasses.
Yeah, and you can see the pictures now. They worked out that because of the ways that the insect's eyes work, they couldn't use the kind of 3D glasses that we use in the cinema, the polarised 3D glasses. So they used old school coloured 3D glasses.
Red and the blue.
Yeah, the red and the blue. But of course, insects' eyes don't work very well in the red spectrum. So they had to use, I think it was a blue and a green. And you can see there are pictures online of the praying mantises with these little glasses stuck to their faces. And they found that when they played the footage of an insect on a computer monitor, well, if it wasn't in 3D using this blue-green system, well, the mantises ignored it completely. But as soon as they played the 3D version with the green and the blue, well, the mantises went for it. You know, they thought it was an item of food.
Oh, wow. And so do most insects not see in 3D?
Well, it's probably not. Insects have got very, very different vision to ours. So most insects actually have about 5 eyes. So they've got 2 main compound eyes and then these things called ommatidia on the top. They've actually got a cluster of 3 little eyes on the top of the head, many, many insects, which is probably used for when they're flying to find the horizon as well. So their eyesight is very, very different to ours. And yeah, it's not known. Some of the insects and some spiders, for example, probably do see in 3D, but we really don't know.
That's crazy. Producer Amna, what have you brought with you today?
So this research is supposed to be the first of its kind. Some US researchers went through 50 US homes to try to figure out what type of creepy crawlies are in an average US home, and amazingly they found 579 different types of arthropods in people's homes.
579?
So, yeah, and that was like the average, which just kind of shows you the amazing different types of diversity in your house. And I really love the Guardian's article on this, especially the intro, which is like, if you're ever feeling lonely at home,
you've got 579 arthropods in your house with you, just go find them all.
Yeah. I must say, I don't think, if it was the same article I read, I don't think I did like it, because it mentioned this study and then it went straight into the 10 most venomous spiders in the world or something like that. So if you can't talk about spiders without talking about the kind of 0.5% that might actually do some damage.
My news story for this week was that the European Food Safety Authority has done an actual risk assessment as to whether insects could be a sustainable source of protein for human consumption and animal feed, and they have declared that it could, and that the only risks they see to eating insects depends on basically how we farm them, so how we rear and process them. But yeah, so there's been a lot of talk about insects being the sort of food of the future, and by 2018 there's going to be insect ready meals in your supermarkets, and it does actually look like it's heading that way. We've got a risk assessment, surely it's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a kind of serious side to this story. So whenever you see this in the newspapers or TV, well, you see these pictures of kind of mealworms on top of a rye beater or whatever, you know, you see these kind of whole deep fried insects. Now, in fact, the reality of it won't be like that. The reality of it, when we're talking about eating insects, we're mainly talking about using insect protein. So you might have a kind of burger or something like that, and inside the burger, well, there is some protein. So it's basically you farm insects on a large scale, and in fact, some of them can break down waste. So they take our kind of the stuff from our compost bin and turn it into really usable
protein.
Oh,
they're just amazing.
Yeah, no, it's incredible.
Everything.
But this idea of eating kind of deep fried locusts, well, that's not what we're talking about. But there really is a serious side, because of course there are huge proportions of people around the world that don't have enough protein in their diet. People that are really on the breadline in developing countries. So this idea of eating insects is a fascinating way of kind of solving that problem, and not in such a gruesome way as is depicted on TV and in the newspapers.
And also much more environmentally friendly than growing a cow.
Absolutely. They're so, so efficient, insects, at turning vegetable matter into protein, for example.
Oh. We've run out of time, but before we go to your final song, we need to say what the nation's favourite insect is. Can I just quickly ask, what is your favourite insect?
My favourite insect, for pure reasons of pure charisma, is a praying mantis from Central Africa called Idolomantis diabolicum. So it's got this incredible Latin name, and it lives up to its Latin name. It's a really big, chunky praying mantis. Its eyes are pointed. It looks very kind of alien-like from our perspective. And it's got this sensational threat display where it holds its arms up and makes this huge eye spot. It looks like something from another world. And of course, we're the things from another world, but it just looks, to a human, it looks absolutely incredible.
Oh, that is such a good choice. Kind of more interesting than the actual nation's favourite, which is ladybirds. 53 species of ladybirds, and they are beloved of children's rhymes and are useful predators in the garden, eating your green flies that would otherwise be destroying a lot of your crops. So they have come in as the nation's favourite. The most reviled were cockroaches, and the most feared were wasps. Not surprisingly, as they can actually hurt you.
I wish that had all been the other way around. If we had another half an hour to talk about this, well, then I'm sure that I could convince everybody that it was actually the other way around. That the wasps should be our favourite things, and cockroaches aren't so bad after all.
Well, we'll leave you with that thought. What is your final song and why? Behave Yourself.
What is the final song? Oh, yeah, Behave Yourself. Yeah, so this is, and again, picking another genre of music, this is a blues song by Booker T and the MGs, and with the Hammond organ, which is a sensational instrument.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Tim. It's been fascinating.
Oh.